There's always going to be marketers and brands and companies who complain about the change and who kind of hold on to the old ways of doing things. Like, there are brands right now who are just now embracing having websites when there are companies that don't have websites. Welcome to Marketers Talking Marketing. I'm your host, Jess. Today we're joined by Mallory, and we are going to talk about tips for marketers during a recession, I call it. So if you have to now market with less budget than you've had before, what can you do to do more with less? And if you're a marketer who is thinking of going to an earlier stage startup, which we're seeing those are still hiring quite a few marketers compared to larger enterprises, what are things that you should know about joining a startup as a marketer before you actually get in? So Mallory, thank you so much for joining us. For the listeners at home, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. So I'm Mallory. Even though I have an American accent, I'm based in Northern Ireland, which is very fun. I'm trying to get an Irish accent, but I can't, so working on it. I've been in marketing for about 12 years, always B2B, always SaaS, and for the most part, startups. So that's why we're here. I don't have all the answers to recession stuff, so please do not think I do.
No pressure.
If you did, then you're, you know, severely misled. But, you know, I am trying to help you understand that you can do a lot more with less, because startups have been doing it for years.
Yeah. So Mallory, you spent your career in really earlier stage startups for quite a chunk of it, where you might not really have a pretty small budget sometimes, or no budget, and you got to get creative.
Yep.
What would you tell a marketer who's experiencing maybe for the first time in their career a large budget cut where they're, you know, adjusting to this new norm that they have?
Yeah, well, first, don't panic. I mean, I've been doing it for years. I haven't died. I don't think anybody's died from it. So, you know, you're fine. But, you know, if you've had budget cuts, you're going into a startup and you're the first person, like right now, I'm a one woman team. So just kind of know that you should really focus. And, you know, you have some sort of a budget, I imagine, otherwise they wouldn't have marketing on board. But really think about what are the one or two things specific to what you're trying to do that'll have the most growth, and just do them really well. You don't have to do all the things. And I know on LinkedIn, there's a lot of people saying you got to do all the things and other things are dead, so try this new thing. But just focus on what you need and just, you know, you'll know what that is.
Yeah, that's actually a future episode plug, because I'm seeing a resurgence of people saying email marketing is dead. So future episode coming on email marketing not being dead with it. Do you have favorite like tactics or techniques or channels to go to when you have less money to work with?
Yeah. So I'm still a big advocate for account-based marketing, and I do firmly believe you can do that with nothing. And you know, the other thing I love doing is events, and saying email's dead, I always get told, well, events don't work. They're all spam. They're scamming us for money, all these things. You can do both those things and get a huge amount of impact as if you had a huge marketing team and a huge budget, by doing such small things for it. So those are the two that I would, you know, suggest looking into.
I have heard so many times people say events don't work, and then going and looking and saying, okay, how are you tracking? How are you nurturing them? Are you segmenting your event attendees from registrants and no-shows? What are you really doing with it? And getting creative, you know, going, I could not afford a developer advocate in one of my roles. I wanted a dev advocate. I couldn't afford the role. Mm-hmm. And so we made a dev advocate program. And we would just bring a bunch of extra swag with us to all these trade shows we went to. And if we saw, and we knew who the dev advocates were in the space, we ABM'd them. We knew who they were. And if they came up to the booth, and everyone at the booth had the list of names memorized. So if they came up to the booth and we recognized them, like, oh my God, thank you so much. Hey, do you want some extra stickers to give away? And so we would give them these swag kits. And then when they would go to conferences we weren't sponsoring, we would still have a presence there because they had our stickers and our swag that they were giving away. You know, there's creative stuff you can do too to try and expand the reach beyond spending $100,000 on a 20x20 booth.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Another thing that people don't really think about events, and I could talk about this all day, so I won't, but I'll say this one thing, is that for events, it's not, you don't just pay for the event or, you know, host the event and there you go. It should be like a couple months in advance and maybe a couple months after, like a full on quarter, multi-quarter strategy that then ties into your content and your social and everything else that you're doing. But you're all doing it really focused to really amplify the one event and getting the most from it. It's not just, you know, I'm going to pay $30,000, go to this conference, and, well, I didn't get anything, so obviously it was a scam. That's not how it works.
Yeah. It definitely, I'm the same, like, 2 month timeline for post event. Yeah. And it's really about like getting creative and doing a little more with what you have with it, which, you know, I think people with larger budgets would also benefit from that. So it's not exclusive to smaller, but it's like, when you have less money, you have to be so much more thoughtful about where every dollar goes to make sure you're really squeezing every penny you can out of it. I love events. They're one of my favorite things in the world.
The other thing that like you can do that is kind of free, depending on how you do it, is partnerships. And as a startup, it's sometimes hard to get people to believe that you're serious enough because you're so small in the ecosystem that they want to spend time on partnering with you. Or, you know, you don't know where to start with partners. But that can be a huge impact because your partners that are bigger, they have more budget, they have bigger teams, they have all these things. So you can actually, you know, network with those people. And if you come up with a strategy and kind of take the load off them having to do it, they're more likely to engage with you. And then you can do joint events with, you know, no budget or all those things. And you don't have to promote it as much with, you know, actual spend because they have the following. And then you can kind of, you know, network off that.
I will say I've been the bigger fish in that partnership deal, and they were brands that would come up and they wanted to work together. It's like, you don't have our target audience. You're, you know, Series A, like you don't have the people we want to talk to. But there was one who said, we'll do everything. We'll do all the work. And so I was like, all right, done. Like,
yeah. We'll do.
We did, I think, a joint webinar series with them, and they did, they found like an expert to join on the panel. They did all the webinar prep. We hosted the landing page and the data, so we got it all directly into our system and shared it with them, which I appreciated, but they did all of the work for it. It was a win-win. And so, but if they would not have come up with that, we wouldn't have partnered with them because they were so small. So there's definitely ways to still get into some of those companies that otherwise might think you're a tiny little fish in the ocean.
Exactly.
But, you know, maybe you're, I was trying to think of an analogy related to a fish in the ocean and I didn't have anything. Maybe you're like a prize fish.
Maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know shit about fish.
I was trying to think of, you know, the fish from Elf that has, it's not a fish. It's like the whale thing with the, it's like a unicorn whale.
No.
Hi, buddy. You know that fish?
Oh.
Mr.
Like a narwhal?
Narwhal, yes.
Yeah.
That'd be like a prize fish.
Vaguely. Was there that theory that, yeah, well, anyways, that's a whole other story about mythicism in sea creatures.
Yeah. Another thing I'm also not an expert on.
Yeah. Do you find that when you're, you know, at these earlier stage companies, maybe the only marketer, does leadership understand that you have limited resources to have limited impact? Or do you find that leadership is often like, do everything all the time with no help?
So it depends, and that's where experience comes in. So, you know, having those initial talks before you join the company, they're always like, oh, let's do everything. You can obviously do everything that 20 people in another company do. And you have to set the precedent up front of like, well, I'm not good at these things. And you have to be honest of like, you know, I'm personally not very good at Google Ads, for example. I'll do them, but I'm not a specialist in it. So you have to kind of say, you know, I'll set everything up, but at this point, we'll need to hire or outsource things. But then at the same time, the stuff that you are doing is very visible in the company. So then you have to be comfortable kind of building in public, but internally, because anything you do in marketing, obviously you're the only person. So everybody in the company is going to know that's you doing that. And you have to kind of just kind of put pride aside and be a bit awkward, try things and be comfortable that others are watching.
Yeah, it is kind of that double-edged sword. You can have a much larger impact and you have direct visibility into, I mean, often like, first marketing reports and like the CEO or one of the founders. So you get a lot more of that visibility, but often also they have more visibility into what you're doing with it. I'm having like flashbacks to, I used to work at a company and the founder had a lot of like really strong opinions on copy for the website. Mm-hmm. And it was like, you are a technical founder. Like, yeah. I understand what you're saying, but you're like the end user, not the buyer.
Yeah.
Like let's calm that down.
Yeah.
Definitely a lot of managing up needed.
Oh yeah. That goes, I had one where the CTO, and he's amazing, but he was very opinionated on marketing technology, even though he didn't use most of it, but was fighting my corner for like, well, I want to use Asana, not Jira, or I want to use this event tool because I can't just wing it with this other thing that engineers use. And so it's like, you kind of have to go in knowing there will be battles that people have opinions that, you know, when you're that close of a team, but you have to kind of choose the battles that you're willing to die for. So sometimes you just get front and be like, okay, you win. I'm not willing to die on this. I'm going to save my argument for this thing down the road.
Yeah. I think those are also things you can often kind of suss out in the hiring process.
Oh yeah.
You know, when interviewing, like there was a company I interviewed for, and for me, okay, for me, if what I look for, because I often work with or have worked in earlier stage companies too, is there product market fit? And are you investing in product managers and product marketing? Like, because if the product is good and there's good fit and it's, and you have people that are really crafting to make sure that the product is solving actual needs that people are going to pay for, that goes a long ways into making marketing a lot easier. If your product team built for a use case and you can take that use case and market it, that's a different experience than if you don't have product owners and product managers, and if you're not investing in product marketing and you're just investing in sales. Like if you have a sales heavy organization with bad product market fit, that's going to be really difficult to drive pipeline that ultimately may not convert because the fit's not there.
Oh yeah, 100%. And like if you're really small, you also can't rely, like if you're still figuring out marketing fit, you can't rely on marketing to do that for you. That is a company thing. Even though it says, you know, marketing in there, that's not on the marketer that you hire to find it for you. Like the founder should be working towards it. The, you know, the product should be developed towards it, all these different things. And I think that's a huge misconception for like, you know, seed or pre-seed stage companies where, oh, we're going to hire a marketer. They'll find the product market fit. Well, we just focus on the product for us. Go do it. It's like, no, that's not how that works.
Oh my God. I, the worst product launch ever. It took years and they finally killed it. They had built it and they built it because they knew the industry needed it. And then they came to us and said, hey, you know, who do we sell this to? And I was like, wait, hold on. Why did you build? And like, well, we thought like, you know, it'd be fun to build and like the industry would want it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like, you don't have, I'm reading a book right now called Building, and I'll link it in the show notes. The gentleman whose name escapes me, but he essentially ran the team that like made the iPod and a lot of really cool tech. But he had mentioned that one of the things he learned from the first company he went to ended up kind of going out of business. They had this really great product that they all loved and knew would be revolutionary. It was like way ahead of its time. And they didn't have a market to sell into. If you're building something and you're not building for an actual like tangible market failure, you're not building for anyone. And taking that product you built and then asking marketing to go find people to buy it, that's really, it's really hard, especially in a B2B sense. If you're on the consumer side, you know, you can convince someone they need something. Loom is selling deodorant for the entire body right now.
Yeah.
Like, what is that?
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian makes concealer for the legs. She makes body concealer.
Mm-hmm. You know, like very needed.
Yeah. Like you on the consumer side, you can invent shit and convince someone to buy it.
Yeah.
On the B2B side, when your sales cycle is like 6 months and it's $100,000 plus, if you're not building to solve an actual problem, you're going to be in a load of trouble. And oftentimes it is the marketing teams that gets put back on. I always try and listen for that. And the number two thing I listen for is if they like to build stuff in-house instead of getting tools.
Yeah.
For me, that's like a little red flag because I've seen companies where the technical founder and the engineering team are like, we can build our own CRM. We don't need Salesforce.
Yeah.
It's like, no.
No, it's horrendous. My last company, we were in DevOps, and that was a thing that we were up against is like engineering companies we were trying to sell into wanting to just build everything themselves. And I remember there was one big company, it was a big hotel chain. And I remember we got their person who was in charge of all the tech on board. And we were like, oh, well, do you want to buy, you know, how are you doing package management at the moment? And she literally explained that they basically built their own internal GitHub, their internal package manager, like all of these things. And it was like, four different groups of people, like groups in different countries managing this one thing that one tool could solve. And it's like, why?
I love GitHub. There are so many people who use GitHub for shit like that. Or being able, doing record updates that, just like record management. You can buy a tool for like 20K a year to do that. But they're like, oh no, we made like a GitHub repo. And then here's how you update it. And it's like 20 steps and it's like multiple people managing it, but they built it in house. I think they often don't want to like use technology. They want to do it themselves, but that cost is so high.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the recession too is, and you know, I haven't looked into this. I'm just kind of talking out loud, but I imagine that, you know, with all the layoffs and things, a lot of those tools that were built internally, those people are gone. So manage that internally, they're now going to need to go out and get those tools. So even though a lot of marketers are kind of panicking, understandably, because their tech stack's getting shut and their budget's getting shut down, they're also having to replace some of those things with more tools that require more budget. So it's kind of like a chicken and egg kind of situation because they don't have the people on board.
The thing that I saw that I think is different about this recession, different about this wave of layoffs than layoffs that I've seen in the past. And I've been involved with like 3 layoffs in my career. So it's not extensive, but it's not nothing. Is I'm seeing, and I was at a vendor where I worked a lot with marketing teams across B2B SaaS tech companies across the board with different verticals. Mm-hmm. A lot of the layoffs seem to be driven by finance, where it's the finance team giving the list. And so I think in the past, oftentimes finance would say, hey, we need to cut this dollar amount of headcount in order to, you know, make payroll for the future and ensure runway and all that stuff. And they would go back to the teams and say, hey, you know, you need to cut this amount. And so who do you want to get rid of? Like, how are we going to get there? You tell me how you're going to get there, but that's the dollar amount to get to. I think especially companies where they're doing like a 15% layoff, 20% layoff, is finance just going through and they're saying who makes the most, mm-hmm. chop it down. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you probably have all this internal tech that's being ran by individuals who are let go because they're the experienced senior employees who've been there the longest. Yep. And that is who I think we're seeing these layoffs target is a lot more senior employees that, you know, people probably never expected to leave. Yep. The weird thing from my vantage point, too, is I'm seeing a lot more budget for agencies, freelancers, contractors. And there's even some where like they're laying off employees, but hiring them back as contractors. They just don't want that burdened headcount of having to have them on the books for, you know, years. They want that flexibility, but it's definitely like you have somehow more money for technology, but you have less people to run the tech internally mm-hmm. with teams.
Yeah. That's why I also like when you are joining a company as, even if it's not a startup, but it's the first person building out a department or having to figure out what the tech stack is or who to hire and all those things now, you know, agencies, yeah, it's the first thing that comes to mind with doing things quicker. But I actually, in the mentorship program for Demand today, I was meeting with my mentee and she's using an agency to do ABM, but they don't understand any of the attribution. They don't understand anything coming through. And, you know, I don't think attribution, not everything goes back to it, but they're spending all this money on this agency, don't know what's coming from it. Their sales team doesn't know what marketing is bringing in, but they're paying for it. But then, you know, and I love Rollworks and I should probably work there because I love them so much. But
I love them too.
Like Rollworks, she could see the accounts coming.
Yeah.
How much?
I love Rollworks.
All these things. And Rollworks is so affordable for people like that. And then they manage a lot of it for you. Then you don't need the agency and you still don't need to hire, but you're getting everything that your money should be going towards. And
yeah, this podcast is not sponsored by Rollworks, but Jody, if you want to sponsor it.
Yes, please do.
Hit me up.
Please.
I love them too. I think, okay, so this is a little bit of a tangent, but not really. So I recently started an agency. You know, I've gone to the dark side, but I would consider myself a full stack marketer. So what I see though, because I work with other agencies and I've worked with agencies in the past and I did a little agency stint in the past too, is that's exactly what it is. So you have these agencies where you'll have 20 people on a call because everyone is so specialized. They don't know how it works together. And so I think you have to be really careful when you do outsource that stuff because you might end up with like a demand gen agency who doesn't understand sales and all they're doing is trying to drive down your cost per lead. But you can have a low cost. And I used a PPC agency a couple years ago that did that where we had an extremely low cost per lead. We had an insanely high lead volume, but 100% of it was unqualified.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't matter. It's a waste of money if it's not working together. Yeah. And these systems like Rollworks, it costs money. It's not free. I would say, I think they're very competitively well-priced. it's not free, but it saves you so much money because it lets you view that whole picture. It lets you automate a lot of your functions that might otherwise take someone having to manually go through and update things. So when you invest in technology, you're doing it because you're saving money other places, where a lot of companies, they'll just cut budget, they cut tech. But like a new favorite company of mine is Primer.
Oh,
and they will pull together a ton of different data sources. There's like a number of different data sources, the number of which I'm not forgetting, but it's not two or three. It's high. But they're pulling from like Golden Rocks and Apollo and all of these intent and kind of specialized platforms that you otherwise might not directly use. And you don't have to get license costs to them because you use them through the platform. So you get access to the data. And then they allow you to do enrichment on the front end. This is not a plug for them, by the way.
We're just plugging everything right now.
you can do enrichment on the front end. And so like Zoom Info is shit for some things. Like LinkedIn will always be your best source of truth for a recent employee headcount number. It'll always be more up to date. So you can kind of build how you want to enrich things on the front end, enrich your CRM data, and then take that audience and use it for matching to social. And their match rates are like high 90% on most platforms because you're enriching everything on the front end. That tool saves you Zoom Info, multiple license. I mean, you might still need Zoom Info, but it saves you multiple licenses to individual technologies for it. And it saves you time by being able to dynamically upload to your social media. And it makes your campaign performance better because you have better data and better match rates. So when you look at the tool overall, it's impactful to everything. But when you look through a lens of money, it's saying, well, it's expensive. We don't need it. Well, shit, now you need to go get another person. I need a coordinator now because I'm not going to spend my time building audiences.
Exactly. I mean, I'm going to check out that tool. I haven't heard of it. So it sounds amazing. But like, there's so much stigma around tech and agencies and contractors and hiring people. And there's so many different opinions. It's like everything else. There's so many different opinions about what you should do when. You'll know what's right for you. But like, tech can save so much money, even when you're paying. You have to pay for the tech, obviously. But, you know, if you spend it on the right things, that can actually save you even more money than you imagine. You don't have to cut all the tech and then that solves your problems. Same, firing all these people isn't going to solve these businesses' problems. Like, there's not one solution.
Well, and they're really just, they're transferring the dollars to just a different bucket on their accounting sheet.
Yeah. They're probably going to put it into like something else that they have no idea if it brings in money, but they think it does because it doesn't have any marketing on it.
Yeah. Someone told them email marketing's dead, so they don't want to do it anymore. And then someone told them demand capture's out and it's all about demand creation. And, you know, it's like, what's the new? A product like growth is the new ABM. So,
yeah. PLG, MQL, yeah. CAC, all the abbreviations are either dead or new, and then they'll be dead next quarter. And they'll reverse again in three quarters.
It's all the same. What I actually find, what I like a lot about, what I enjoy about some of these trends and these things that come in and out of fashion is you'll see marketers that really, I think of it similar to an algorithm change on a social platform. You will see brands and marketers who make it through and do well. And who I think have that natural curiosity for what can I do that's going to really perform on LinkedIn? I'm starting to see more people use this image format. Can I start doing that? Will that do well? And they're sort of on the cutting edge with it. There's always going to be marketers and brands and companies who complain about the change and who kind of hold on to the old ways of doing things. Like there are brands right now who are just now embracing having websites when there are companies that don't have websites. They just live on whatever Web3 stuff they live on. But I like it because I think it weeds out people who just want to like do the same thing over and over and over again. Like agencies, there used to be a world in which agencies would do social media and would not tie anything back to analytics, attribution, reporting, nothing. And they're dying out. The same thing that agencies that understand ABM, but don't understand tracking and analytics, they're going to die out. And they're going to die out because stuff changes over time. I just went on a little rant with that.
But, I love it. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, I'm not fashionable, but it's kind of like fashion. Like, you know,
I have a Grogu sweater on.
I love it.
I have a sweater with Baby Yoda on it. So
that's more fashionable than a black turtleneck thing. That
I would say that's more fashion. That's more classically fashionable. Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Anyway. Or oh, sorry. Digressing from.
No, I was just going to say, it's kind of like fashion. We're like, you know, 10 years ago, you know, low waist jeans were the thing. And then everybody's like, they're dead. We're never wearing those again. Now it's high waisted. And now they're coming back. Unfortunately, they should be dead. But, you know, that's a whole other story.
So it's my entire elementary school fashion. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing as the cool stuff now.
I know, it's terrible.
Like someone on TikTok had, you know, the headband with the spikes to hold your hair back.
Yes.
She's trying to figure out how to wear it.
Yeah. I tried wearing those as necklaces and as a kid, and you know, obviously that hurt because it stabbed your neck, but that was trendy too, to like wear them both ways.
Yes. Like, yeah. the necklaces, they're like the black plastic that would stretch and like, all that stuff is coming back.
Yeah.
Pencil thin eyebrows.
Yeah. I'm not a fan of that. Some things are like, I know in marketing, nothing really ever dies, but in fashion it should.
Yeah. 100%. I saw someone the other day and they had chunky highlights. And people are commenting and they're like, hey, like, that's not the look. And they're like, no, I want chunky highlights. I don't want it to look natural. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? Like,
thanks, Billie Eilish.
What year is it? Pretty much.
I know.
So the other thing that I think is a little bit unique about this kind of wave of layoffs is that when I look on LinkedIn and I talk to people in the industry, there's larger companies have job postings up on their site. I don't think they're real. No. I don't think they're actually hiring at all.
I'd be scared to take them too.
Also, yes. Startups, though, are, I think, snatching up a lot of this great talent. And there's, I'm really excited to see the new tech companies that come out of like all the Twitter layoffs. But there's tech companies, startups, earlier stage who are now saying, okay, this is going to be a great opportunity to pick up like a PM at Facebook for the last 10 years that I could never get from Facebook. That's gone. And so let me go get this talent. When a marketer, if they're evaluating moving to a startup early stage company, do you have any tips for them or stuff they should just be mindful of or think about when moving to that side of the spectrum?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the stigmas that I immediately think of is when people think of startups, I think they think, oh, I'm not going to get the salary that I want. I'm not going to get the benefits that I want. And yes, I'm in Europe, but I've found that actually it's the opposite. Startups actually give you a lot more because they want you to grow with them. So, you know, I will say if they say that you're a family, still a red flag no matter what company.
Red flag.
But, you know, they're more likely to see your worth because they need you. And not to say big companies don't need you. I mean, it depends on the role, but you can actually see the impact that you have from day one in a startup. You go in and like you have ownership of whatever it is that you specialize in. You can see how your thing ties into sales or product or however the company's set up. So when you're going into a startup, really focus on more what the role entails, because you can still get the ones where, you know, it's a startup, you have to wear 20 different hats. At some point, you're always going to have to, but there's some that take it too far and they're like, you're going to do marketing, you're going to do sales, you're also going to do product, and then we'll get those next year. And that's just really taking the piss from day one. Like, that's not going to work.
Yeah. There are definitely companies where I think the base might be lower, but I've seen, I had a friend who went into an early stage direct-to-consumer company, and he took what I'll say was still like a good salary. It wasn't as high as he had had previously at a larger company, but it was still a good salary. Mm-hmm. They were going for acquisition. They had a timeline for it. And so they said, when we get acquired, we'll give you like 1% of whatever we get acquired for. And then when they got acquired like 2.5 years later, millionaire.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it's almost taking like a smart bet too, where look at that total comp package. So maybe your base salary is a little bit lower. And I will say I'm surprised, because when I've interviewed in the past for earlier stage companies, it was nowhere near as low as I thought it would be. You know, it was still a good amount, but their overall comp packages are often a lot larger. Like, they're going to give you more options and you're getting your shares before they've diluted with more rounds of investing. So you're going to get more options. You're often going to get a much more flexible work-life balance. You know, just the joy of being able to like buy tech without spending 6 months with procurement. Mm-hmm. It's just easier to get shit done.
Yeah.
I think though, you need to be prepared to get shit done.
Yeah.
If you've been a VP for 10 years and you haven't been hands-on like building social copy and building workflows and having to set up your HubSpot reporting, it could be challenging. Like, you got to be ready to get shit done until you can afford to hire someone to get the shit done with you.
Yeah. I think you definitely also grow faster in a startup because you're taking on so many things that, you know, in a bigger company, you don't have to do because somebody else does it. So the whole, oh, that's not my job thing, you know, sometimes can be annoying, honestly, because you don't want to do certain things. You get out of your comfort zone, but you grow faster. And like, you know, I've only been in marketing 12 years. And just by doing the startup thing, I was CMO at my last company by the time I was 30, which if I was like a Twitter or something the whole time, I'd probably still be, you know, way down the food chain. And things like that is just insane. But when you're going in these companies too, that's where like you're talking about the product needs to be really good. You need to also know like who are the customers buying it? Do they have customers? And then like, do they understand that they have competitors? Because there's also companies where they don't think they have competitors. Everybody wants to create a new category, but there can't be a category for every company.
Category creation is the new everything. I am so sick of hearing about category creation.
I know. So
like, but that's, there's a company I went into as an account manager, and I had an idea for a way to grow revenue. We were doing this, it was a social publishing platform, and we would spend, for like one client, we did paid social. And I had done this in the past for like my own podcast, and my, I had a company prior to that that was essentially a media company that just arbitraged ad revenue. And I felt like I wasn't ready to be a founder. And so I sold it and went into working in venture-backed companies. But I was like, I think we could make money on this. And so I took that, got a sales intern part-time assigned to me, got him full-time, made him a full-time employee, and then did time tracking and just proved ROI to be able to get more employees. And so in 2 years, I grew it from myself doing this for like one client to a dedicated function with headcount to like 14 employees, including engineers building reporting platform interface. We were like an early Pinterest beta partner, and we got up to about 44 million in committed ad spend in like 2.5, 3 years.
Yeah.
And I was 26.
Yeah.
You don't do that if you go to Ford.
No, and it sounds terrifying. Like, oh, by the time I'm 30, maybe I won't be ready for that. But like, you can do anything by the time you're any age. Like, just build up the skills and figure out what you want faster too. Like, you can learn within 2 years in a startup, I hate doing this thing, or I love doing this. Like, I hate social media personally. Hate it, but I'll do it because I have to do all the things. So, you know, it's that kind of thing in a startup where eventually you can hire somebody to kind of, you know, you hire for your weaknesses or things that you don't like doing if you have that privilege. But initially you get to figure out what that is and do more of what you love, less of what you hate over time.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I recommend all if you're listening to this and you're a recent or soon to be graduate, BDR at a large company or go to an early stage company in whatever role it is that's client facing. Get time with customers, especially when customers are mad at you. learn how to work with a mad at you customer and make them still have a good experience.
Yeah.
And they're both starting points, right? Like, no one goes into a BDR with a plan on being a BDR in 10 years. Your BDR is it's an entry point to more roles. Working at a startup gives you, I think, that same opportunity because there's so much to do. We didn't have a support team for a long time too. So we'd have to like do support and answer tickets and do like password resets. And it was just marketing, sales engineer. Like, you get to wear a lot of hats.
Yeah. But that's the fun part too. Because then you also learn about the other departments because you as those departments grow. So you're like, oh, actually, I know completely what this department used to do and how they've grown. That's cool.
Your depth of product knowledge is so different when you've had all those functions with it. Yeah, 100%. I mean, I recommend, unless you're a marketer who knows that you, like, there are spots where I know if I had to do the execution, I'm burnt out. I'm not going to do it. Like, I love campaigns and performance, and I'll build a LinkedIn campaign here and there. But if my entire day was just performance marketing, I would be exhausted with it. But I'll help you build a strategy, and I have people that I can refer you to and like can work with on it.
Yeah.
And if you know that you're like at that point where the execution is going to be too much, don't go to a startup unless you're only go there if you're ready to get your hands dirty and get stuff done.
Yeah, 100%. And if you're okay, like, you know, not being too proud. Like, you have to say, I don't know how to do this, and go into, you know, groups of people that have the same job title as you and be like, guys, I actually don't know how to do this one thing. How do I do it? And like, be humble and ask people to help. Because I think people are always willing to help. People are just more afraid to ask. So that's a big thing.
Yeah. Groups like Demand, which is Metadata's community, Pavilion, I've been actively involved in. I see in there, people are always sharing their templates with each other. You know, they'll post and say, I'm doing like, we're doing a rebudget mid-year. Like, what do I do? Can I talk to someone? People are so, I think today's day and age of marketing is much more blue ocean than it was 10, 20 years ago. You know, the early days of tech, this is going to be a whole conspiracy theory rabbit hole we're going into for a second. The Peter Thiel days of tech, in the early days of tech, I think sales teams were really, really competitive with each other. Often it wasn't really territory based. You'd have round robining. And so I think sales being so competitive drove competition across the entire go-to-market organization, where marketers would start to be that way too. And because you need to like have these insane growth models and you need to make these massive numbers, you don't want to work with people of other companies. You just want to do your thing and run with it. And I think in the past decade, we've seen marketing become such a collaborative environment where I see marketers at similar companies that are talking to each other about what they're seeing working and not working.
Yeah.
And they're going at it from that standpoint. So if you join a community like Demand, Pavilion, there's Peak, there's a few other ones.
Yeah.
If you join, the communities are often so open. Anything you need help with, people are willing to jump on a call for, you know, which is such a, I can't imagine doing life without it, to be honest, because how do you find your peer group? How do you know what's cutting edge if you're not talking to people doing it? Because by the time that Ad Age is sharing it or social media today, it's freaking old news and it's not going to be a competitive advantage anymore.
Exactly. And it also goes back to saving you money because you might be doing something wrong and have no idea. And somebody else says, oh, actually, no, do this one little thing. Like,
I'll give you an example. Elon Musk, if you're listening, this is for you. Twitter in, I think, like 2014 or 2015 said, so it used to be if you added someone, if you start your tweet with at and their name, it would only show that tweet to people following both of you. And they said, oh, it's fixed. It never fixed on desktop. It never fixed. And so you'd always have to do period and then at the name or else it only shows people following both of you, even though they would claim that that wasn't the case. But if you go and you do it and go and tweet at someone and then go and look at your profile and it'll show up in your mentions and replies.
Yeah.
It doesn't show up everywhere. It's still a mention or reply. And I've told people that and they like don't believe me. And then they try and they're like, oh, shit. That's why my tweets mentioning people do so poorly.
Yep.
You know?
Thanks, Elon. I'm blaming him.
Yeah. He wasn't Thanks, there, Elon. Still his it's fault. His. Yeah. If you can fix that, please, that'd be great. You know, also stop destroying Twitter. I tried to buy the BERT. They had the San Francisco office liquidated everything. And they had an auction. And so they had this like planter sculpture with an at in it. It's like a big at. And then they had one that was a trade show prop and it had the bird light. I think it went for like $10,000.
What?
I got outbid at 100.
But who gets that money, Elon?
Yeah, it all goes back to Twitter.
Yeah, he doesn't need it.
It'll split with the auction company and then, but they were selling like monitors and desks and just, it's like most, I don't know what portion of the office it is, but it was a decent portion.
Oh my God.
That's on that note,
yeah.
Thank you everyone for joining us for another episode of Marketers Talking Marketing. Mallory, thank you for joining us and giving Thanks us your tips me. And advice. If you're listening on audio and you want to see the podcast in action, check out YouTube. If you're watching on YouTube, you know, too late. You already looked at us, so you're here. Thanks for joining us. If you want to learn more about us, any of the tools that we mentioned, we'll put links in description for everything. And see you guys next time.
Bye.